This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. In today's program, we'll look at the latest crisis developments in Egypt, and we'll be looking at the situation of Julian Assange, who turned up overnight at the Ecuadorian embassy in London seeking asylum. We'll speak with attorney Michael Ratner about the case of Julian Assange. Also, there's a summit taking place down south. We'll be speaking with Lacey McCauley about ongoing events at the G20 summit. All that and more. This is 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we'll be right back in just a moment with Nasir Arouri on the latest crisis in Egypt. This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we begin today's program with the latest developments in Egypt. We're joined live by Nasir Arouri, a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth, and also the author of Dishonest Broker, the U.S. Role in Israel and Palestine. Dr. Arouri has also been looking at the events in Egypt, where there is now a contested election, the dissolution of parliament, and quite a bit of turmoil. We begin with this, Nasir. What is the latest you understand about the vote count for the presidential election?
Well, the last I heard is that vote count seems to favor the Muslim Brothers.
Well, there are contending claims. At first, the Muslim Brotherhood candidate claimed to have 51.5% of the vote, or 52%. And then a few hours later, the holdover from the Mubarak regime also claimed to have an equal number of votes. And the announcement was scheduled to have been made on Thursday, but now there is talk of a delay. Can you tell us how to distinguish between the Muslim Brotherhood candidate, Mr. Mosri, and the establishmentarian candidate, Mr. Shafiq?
Well, indeed, this is really the big question. I mean, to me, it is not the percentages and so on, but the big question, what's really going on in Egypt, is whether Egypt has undergone a revolution or will be smothered by a counter-revolution. To me, this is the big question. Well, a victory for either one of the two candidates was really out of the question. Ahmed Shafiq, the candidate of the Supreme Military Council, could not have brought about a revolution, that is for sure. The second candidate, Mohamed Morsi, who is the leader of the Muslim Brothers, he could not have brought about a revolution either, because the Muslim Brotherhood are not a revolutionary party. It is a status quo party, and it is not going to lead to revolution. The only force in Egypt which could have achieved a real change, a real revolution, is the undifferentiated public. The public that spent night after night after night in Liberation Square, or what is known in Egypt as Maidan al-Tahrir, Liberation Square. This is the undifferentiated public that could have brought about a revolution. And they seem to be not in the picture, because the focus is really on the Muslim Brothers and on the Supreme Military Council. So neither one of these could have brought about a change. A change that will be real social change. A change in foreign policy, and that means Egyptian policy towards Israel and the United States, and whether it will continue with the peace treaty, so-called, with Israel, and a revolution that will bring about a real distribution of power. And that's what we're talking about when we talk about a revolution. And that is really the big question.
In the election, what happened to the third force, the people of Tahrir Square, the progressive modernists, the April 6th movement, and others? How did they get eliminated? I understand that when there was a rush to claim victory in reforming Egypt governance, that people thought that there would be a new constitution drawn up in 6 months, and perhaps there was a bit of premature sense of victory in the Muslim Brotherhood took advantage of their greater organization, and now the independents have been sidelined.
That's exactly what happened, unfortunately, for all those people who want to see a real revolution and real social change. The Muslim Brothers, they have an apparatus, they have an organizational structure, they have a follower, they have a following, I should say, throughout Egypt, and Egypt is a large country of 98 million people, and they have a good deal of support. Then the third group, which is the military, they're the ones who really had the guns and the power, and so the pro-democracy, let's call them the pro-democracy, the ones that I call the undifferentiated public. It's not that undifferentiated. These people did not really have an organization like the others, and consequently, they did not do well. But that does not mean that they are out of the picture. There is still a chance for them to try to recover. Particularly, I believe that their aspirations correspond to the aspirations of the majority in Egypt. This was not a majoritarian deal here. It does not really express the will of the public, the result of these elections. The Muslim Brothers, not the other party, which is the military council. And it's going to be a question of whether, in the end, this is a revolution or a counter-revolution, really.
The parliament has been dissolved by the military edict. What does that say about the legislative branch, much less the presidential one?
Well, that's a very bad omen. I mean, that's the first thing that the military is doing here, is dissolving the parliament. Which tells you so much about democracy and the prospects for democracy. It means that the party of Mubarak, may he rest in peace, or not so much in peace, the party of Mubarak and Ahmed Shafiq with the military are going to rule with an iron fist. If they're allowed to, and I think that given that they have a monopoly of the use of force, the military, the weapons, it seems that they are capable of doing it in the short run. But again, the long term is different, because all the reasons that impelled the Egyptians to rise in this impressive manner, night after night after night in Maidan al-Tahrir, or Liberation Square, was the true measure of the people's will. And for the time being, this is not showing, but I believe it is there.
One of the other casualties of the military action is this. One of their spokespersons said that in the future, the rights and responsibilities of the president will be the rights and responsibilities that are defined for the president. In other words, a tautology. This body also now has usurped from parliament the writing of the new constitution. and presumably will issue whatever form of constitution that they wish. So what is the importance of the new constitution, if any, if ever there will be?
Well, that's another problem, you see, which indicates the aggressive nature of the Supreme Military Council and the military as a whole. Their contempt for the public opinion, their contempt for the will of the people, it is being shown in what you just mentioned in terms of the elections, the constitution.
We're speaking about the current situation in Egypt, in which there has been a magnificent move to take power by the Supreme Armed Forces Council. We're speaking live with Nasir Arouri, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth. And Professor Arouri, the additional interest in Egypt comes back to the United States, which for so many decades now has made Egypt one of the largest recipients of U.S. foreign and military aid. How does the American interest figure into the manipulations of Egyptian politics?
Well, I think this is really the major foreign policy issue, not only in Egypt, but in the Middle East, and indeed in the world, because we should remind ourselves of the Cold War of the 1950s and that era when Nasser was the head of Egypt. The politics of Egypt and the politics of the region had a different taste, had a different character. And I think that there is yearning for that among Egyptians and Arabs, and that this yearning will not be satisfied unless it is going to be possible for all concerned to make a real sizable change in the foreign policy of Egypt. But this is something, you see, that is very difficult and possibly undoable, given the way America conducts its policy nowadays, and the willingness, I should say, and ability of the United States to allow a change, a real social change in Egypt, are quite circumscribed, I would say, because there are too many internal forces here in this country who are opposed to it and who would not want to see the treaty with Israel dropped, because that will make a sizable change in the balance of power. I don't think that the U.S. is for that kind of a balance of power. The U.S. wants to ensure that the status quo remains, and that whether it is Muslim Brothers or any other party, don't rock the boat.
One other question for you, Dr. Arouri. There was a time people thought that democracy was being born again. Egypt. But now there's the odd report from the military that the former leader, Hosni Mubarak, is now near death again. What do you make of that announcement?
Well, I think that I don't really consider this to be extremely significant, because he's politically dead anyway, and his successor, his would-be successor, or the successor that his cronies want, is Ahmed Shafiq, who was going to be the aspirant for the presidency. I think Mubarak's living or dying was not going to really have an impact on it. The impact would be felt only if the pro-democracy elements were to get their act together, but that's a very uphill task, because that means building a revolution, building an organization from nothing. I mean, in 1952, the Egyptian revolution was called a military coup, and some people called it an Egyptian revolution. But there came a time when Nasser gathered his party together, and he introduced a program which had what he called Arab socialism, Arab nationalism, non-alignment, Arab unity. I mean, he had a program that they were pursuing, but he died, and with him died the program, and came Sadat, Anwar Sadat, with his open door policy. I think that there is a sizable portion of society in Egypt and the Arab world that is waiting for a rebirth of Nasserism and Nasserites, something that could bring about a revolution.
Well, that's where we must leave it for today, with much gratitude for your insight, Dr. Nasir Arouri of
My
the
pleasure.
University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth. And we'll stay in touch with you as events develop. Thank you for being on 5 O'Clock Shadow.
Very welcome.
Coming up, Julian Assange.
Upstairs room in Blackpool, by the side of a northern sea, the army had my father, and my mother was having me. Military madness was killing my country. Solitary sadness comes over.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and people around the world woke up today to the surprise announcement that the editor-in-chief of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, who had been under house arrest in England, was now at the Ecuadorian embassy to the United Kingdom, where he is seeking asylum because he fears for the conditions he will face if he is extradited to Sweden and then probably to the United States. To help clarify these breaking developments, we're happy to be joined by Julian Assange's American lawyer, Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome back, Michael.
Robert Knight, it's always good to be with you. You've been doing a great job as usual. I was surprised, as you were, when I got a note or a text from someone saying, Julian Assange has just gone into the Ecuadorian embassy and is asking for political asylum. And so I'm trying to figure out how to sort it out. And, of course, I have a good understanding of it, and I think you actually summarized it pretty well. I mean, broadly stated, what was going to happen to him is he'd lost all his appeals against going to Sweden through the English courts. And that's the case in Sweden around Julian Assange is the allegations. There's no charges yet. The allegations that Julian Assange was involved in sexual abuse of two women, and he was wanted for questioning in Sweden, not yet, if at all, for a criminal charge. And he was in England at the time that they've been requesting him from Sweden, and he resisted that, going to Sweden, not because I think it was to him the key issue of whether he went to Sweden and answered questions. That could have resulted in a few different results. It could have resulted in no charges. It could have resulted in charges. It could have resulted in a trial. But I don't think that was his, that's never been his biggest worry. His biggest worry is if and when he went to Sweden, would it be easier for the United States to get its hands on him? And we can talk about why the United States wants to get its hands on him. But when I heard about it, I said, well, he had really two bad choices, one worse than the other. The worst choice that would have happened is on July 7th, which is, I think, roughly the day he was going to have to be taken to Sweden in custody. He would have gone into Sweden. They would have put him in prison. They have no bail in Sweden at all for this. It wasn't charges, but even for this kind of allegation. And he would have been more or less incommunicado in Sweden. And then even assuming Sweden decided not to charge him with any kind of sexual abuse crime, at that moment, he wouldn't have been released, it's likely, because the United States would have been right there in the courtroom saying, here we are, it's an extradition warrant, and he would remain in jail. And then ultimately, assuming he would not beat that extradition warrant in Sweden, because Sweden is pretty familiar, really goes along with what the United States wants, ultimately, he would have wound up in a prison in the United States where he was facing conditions and a trial that we can talk about. So he had, that was one of his choices, let himself broadly get into the hands of the United States ultimately, or the other one, get himself into an embassy and ask for political asylum. And considering the consequences of what he was facing, if the United States ever gets his hands on him, where politicians have even called for him to be murdered, that was a really bad choice had he had to go that way. Not that it's an easy choice to go into the Ecuadorian embassy, because who knows what the outcome is. And again, you and I can talk about that.
Michael Ratner, you certainly have been doing wonderful work with the center and your colleagues on the issue of people who are brought for detention into the United States. And this may not be unrelated to the potential fate of Julian Assange as the editor of WikiLeaks, which published, of course, the video collateral murder about the civilians killed by American troops in Iraq, as well as the treasure trove of the State Department secret cables. But the latest publication of WikiLeaks was from the for-hire intelligence agency known as Stratfor, in which the leader of that group said that he had inside information that there is a sealed indictment for Julian Assange. What is your estimate of the truth of that claim, and what could he be facing here?
You know, a lot of the discussion is, well, you don't know there's an indictment, Michael Ratner. You don't know there's an indictment, Julian Assange. So, you know, why aren't you going to Sweden? You don't know that. To me, the first thing is, if there's no indictment, and if there's no potential prosecution, or if there's no targeting of Julian Assange by the United States, then if the United States says that, and while I haven't spoken to Julian about this, but if the United States says that he's under no risk of being extradited to the United States and facing charges for what we're going to discuss next, espionage, then I think Julian Assange would go to Sweden, because then, you know, he can deal with that case, and none of us know, you know, the truth or the non-truth of that case, but he can deal with that case in Sweden. And he would. I just think the underlying issue is, once he's in Sweden, he might as well say he's in the United States. So the Stratfor email that you're referring to is the one that says there's a sealed indictment against Julian Assange. And Stratfor, of course, is a private intelligence agency. You know, how reliable? I mean, you know, it is a private intelligence agency. It has close access to people in the CIA and otherwise. So it may well be reliable. I add that to other facts that I know, when I make my estimate that it's very likely there's an indictment or a potential indictment of Julian Assange. I add to that that there's an ongoing grand jury in the Eastern District of Virginia, you know, one of the more conservative courts. It's been investigating WikiLeaks and Bradley Manning. Bradley Manning, of course, the private who allegedly leaked the documents to WikiLeaks. Bradley Manning, who is currently on trial, currently going through the proceedings of various phases of a court-martial at Fort Meade. And that grand jury was looking into both Bradley Manning and WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. And there's been witnesses called before that grand jury. So the speculation, that's not speculation, the Stratfor claim that there's a sealed indictment against Julian has foundation. And we've also sent people and gone to various phases of the Bradley Manning trial. And at that trial, it has come out that from FBI agents that they're investigating various civilians. Bradley Manning, of course, was in the military. Various civilians who are founders and or work at WikiLeaks. So we're talking about, you know, you put that together with you know, all these politicians and everybody else calling for prosecution of Julian Assange, and you're saying he's taking a high risk in going to Sweden, is what I would say. And you ask me, Robert, well, what are the charges? Well, you know, Bradley Manning is being charged under military law with all kinds of computer hacking kinds of stuff and with aiding the enemy, which is, you know, somewhat equivalent to espionage. We have a U.S. espionage statute that has never really been used against journalists or publishers. But on the other hand, they are looking at it, at this grand jury, and looking at it with regard to Julian Assange. And we have to put it in the context of the Obama administration having prosecuted six whistleblowers already, which is double the number of whistleblowers prosecuted in all prior administrations, which total three. So they're looking heavily, obviously, at Julian Assange. I think, as I said, that there's most likely an indictment of him already. Espionage carries a life sentence, potentially. One section of it actually carries a death penalty. We would hope Europe wouldn't extradite to a death penalty. They'd have to get an assurance that there isn't before they extradite here, because Europe doesn't agree with the death penalty. But he could technically be facing the death penalty and certainly life in prison. And the conditions, which is where you began the questions, you know, the conditions he'd be held under, we're familiar with because of everybody from our clients at Guantanamo to Pelican Bay to U.S. Federal prisons, to Florence ADX, to what they do with people like Julian Assange. And I can only tell you, the chances are, I wouldn't, whether 100% or not, but they're close to saying he would be put in solitary for a very long time. He would have no communication with the outside world at all, other than people like me or attorneys going to visit him. We would not be able to get on a radio show like yours, Robert, and say, I spoke to Julian Assange and here's what he told me, because the government would claim he has like all this computer stuff in his head and that might be secret codes. And so he would be isolated and cut off. He would then be tried for most likely for an espionage charge, maybe conspiracy to commit espionage, conceivably with Bradley Manning. And he could be put away for a very long time in the context of a country that has gone after him heavily on this, and politicians that want his, that want him executed or to serve life in prison. And this is in the context for me of someone who is a real hero, who has disclosed the collateral murder video concerning the two Reuters journalists who were killed by U.S. Army, including the attacks on children in Iraq. He's disclosed the Iraq war documents, which disclosed that 15,000 people, more civilians, were murdered than the U.S. had said. The Afghan war logs, which again talk about many killings that were unacknowledged before then. And then, of course, the thing that brought the ire up to very high level was the WikiLeaks State Department cables, 100,000 or more cables, that brought out all kinds of hypocrisy in our State Department. So when someone is a whistleblower, or really in that case a publisher, and a journalist like that, that brings out all of that material, they should be treated as heroes because they're lifting the veil of secrecy that so now covers up all all the misdeeds of our government and so undercuts democracy, which is based on knowing what our government does. So he should be a hero. And the people who committed the war crimes, as you and I have discussed before, people like Rumsfeld and others, they should be in the dock and not Julian Assange. So unfortunately, it's utterly reversed in this country. The journalists haven't really gone out and supported Julian Assange, which they should, and supported WikiLeaks. I find it to be terrible. I find his personal and political situation to be just awful right now. The two choices he had, as I started this show with you, were crazy, because one was putting himself in the hands of the United States, and the other is putting himself in the hands of the Ecuadorian embassy, which is, may not be so bad inside the embassy, but even assuming they give him political asylum, how does he get out of the embassy?
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight, and we're speaking live with the attorney in the United States for Julian Assange, Michael Ratner, who is also a co-host of the program Law and Disorder Heard Monday mornings on these airwaves. And Michael, I am so grateful for your taking time out in what must be a very stressful and busy day, given these breaking events. And my final question for you is this. Julian Assange is, again, overnight in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he has sought asylum because of political persecution and the attempt to extradite him to Sweden and then the United States. Now, if I am not mistaken, his being there is a violation of the terms of the bail that was set for him. And short of a transporter beam, if he is indeed granted asylum in Ecuador, as hinted at by President Correa some time ago, short of a transporter beam, I don't see how he could get there without being arrested and then remanded to Sweden and possibly the United States, unless he were granted Ecuadorian citizenship and then appointed a diplomat and thereby have immunity.
That's one I hadn't thought of.
I'm glad to help.
You should be part of our legal team. Anyway, interesting. Very interesting, actually. I hadn't thought of that one, but that's pretty interesting. But you're right. The problem is, even if he gets political asylum, and I'm optimistic, then how does he get out of the embassy? Because when he leaves the embassy, he's no longer protected by the Vienna Convention, which protects the embassy and considers it essentially part of Ecuador for purposes of any other country going into it. When he steps out onto British UK land outside of the embassy, he can be arrested, and there's cops sitting there right as we speak saying, we're going to arrest him. So at that point, he either needs a safe passage from the UK, which seems at this point unlikely. Of course, we never know in these situations. Or your thought of giving him citizenship, perhaps that would work. Or, you know, we thought, you know, he could go into a embassy car with one of those little flags you see all the time, and then drive to the airport and then run into the airplane. Well, that's probably not so great because the Vienna Convention, we don't know, doesn't really necessarily can have the same efficacy with regard to a car, and, you know, has to get out on the tarmac and all that. So the two proposals on now we have in front of us are yours, which is interesting to say the least, and the other one, and I think yours may be more likely than getting him a safe conduct, but you never know. You know, there's a history to this kind of stuff. If you look through the pages, particularly during the Cold War, when people who opposed various, you know, various governments, particularly in the Soviet Union or allied countries, one in Hungary in particular, Cardinal Maczynski, whatever people thought of Cardinal Maczynski, he went into a U.S. embassy in Hungary and stayed there for 14 or 15 years, lived in the embassy, and finally Hungary gave him a safe passage out of the country. So these things are, you don't know how it's going to come out. And I think it's going to make an interesting story. But, you know, the thing you know is we know how it would have come out had they gone to Sweden. And I don't mean about the Sweden abuse charges, because those, I serious as they might be, and none of us know, because there hasn't been a trial yet, and you have to presume him innocent until there's a trial. But serious as those might or might not be, they just pale in comparison to what would have happened to him if the United States gets its hands on him, both in the conditions of his confinement, which if you look at Bradley Manning, who was tortured while he was in confinement, and in what would have happened to him at trial. So he made, of the bad choices he had, he probably made the one that made the most sense for himself.
Well, Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights and of Law and Disorder, I thank you so much today for so well representing, both on 5 O'Clock Shadow and in the courts, your client, Julian Assange.
Robert Knight, it's always good to talk to you, and pleased you're still with us at WBAI.
All right. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. More after this.
This is Julian Assange. You're listening to WBAI New York. Stay strong and keep listening.
And this is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. My name is Robert Knight, and we now turn to La Paz, where the G20 summit has been taking place. But in addition to that, the People's Summit in La Paz, Mexico. And we're now joined live by Lacey McCauley. And Lacey, you have been monitoring events both in the official and in the popular summit. What is the latest development there?
Here in La Paz, Mexico, it's 2 hours away from Cabo, Mexico, where the official G20 summit took place the last 2 days, Monday and Tuesday of the week. So it wrapped up last night with an official statement being sent out from the G20 summit the leaders of the world making statements. We saw press conferences from Vladimir Putin and from Russia, Mexican president, French president, Russian president, and most of the other countries represented. So the G20, of course, is a summit of the 20 most significant economies in the world. And it's a summit of the presidents, the finance ministers, and and their staffs. And, you know, it's been taking place regularly. The G20 has been taking place regularly since 2008. The city of Cabo, the tiny, it's a rather small, luxurious beach resort town, has been under lock and key. And the citizens of Cabo have been required to carry identification. The schools have been closed. I've heard reports from one woman in Cabo. She was told that she, even though she was pregnant, she wouldn't be able to go to the hospital if she were having the baby. She was lucky because the baby was born last week. Cabo has been under lock and key. But here in La Paz, we've been holding the People Summit to discuss our own solutions to the crises that we face, to discuss our own solutions to the global financial crisis and the global climate crisis. The People Summit, it started in Mexico City last week. We traveled to La Paz for the 2 days that the G20 summit was taking place. And now many of the participants will be traveling to Rio, where, of course, the Rio Plus 20 climate summit is taking place. And, basically, it's the important thing is that the people of the world, here at the People Summit, we don't look to these institutions to solve our problems. We look to ourselves to solve our own problems, because it's very clear that the neoliberalist policies of the G20 do not represent, they don't serve the people of the world.
Lacey McCauley, one of the issues among the economies around the world is this concept of austerity. We see that mushrooming in places like Greece and France and Italy and the European Community and European Union, and certainly here in the United States. What are the policies that are being discussed at G20 that could adversely affect the services delivered to the people of Mexico, or for that matter, anyone in the hemisphere here? What are the dangers of the G20 deliberations?
The G20 deliberations essentially reinforced that austerity is something that they support fully as a way to address the crisis. There was a lot of debate. Certain actors, feel that not as much austerity is needed, but the official outcome of the summit itself reinforces that austerity measures are something that they want to pursue. They want more of it. So austerity measures, these are the policies that young people are out in the streets protesting in Greece. Also, we saw large protests in Ireland when austerity measures were being implemented there. They're essentially the government saying that government doesn't need to work for the people, that they are austerity measures include closing social services, weakening retirement benefits, weakening the education system, and essentially shredding the safety net and the services that the government is supposed to provide for its people. And so these austerity measures, well, Felipe Calderon, the Mexican president, actually said it best. He was speaking in the press conference yesterday evening to conclude the G20 summit in Cabo, and he likened the austerity measures actually to bullets that need to be, quote, reloaded again and again. And I think that metaphor is entirely appropriate. The policies are like bullets, and they harm the people of the world, and they harm the environment. And certainly we don't need more of them.
Well, Lacey, what have the people at the People's Summit been proposing as an alternative to austerity?
So the G20, the official G20, issued its release, its statement yesterday evening. And the People's Summit, we issued our own release, the statement of the People's Summit against G20. We essentially outlined not only our reasons for opposing the G20, we declared it as an illegitimate body, but we outlined the type of things that the people need for our future, and essentially we discussed specific policies such as the creation of a new and better financial and monetary system that guarantees control and regulation of banking and financial entities, eliminating speculation and the havoc that financial speculation wreaks on the rest of the world, a reinforcement of the right for countries to protect their economies. Protectionism, of course, is considered something that the G20 stands entirely against. In their official declaration, they stated that protectionism, a country protecting its own economy, is actually something that they're entirely against. But we know that protectionism actually is a country protecting its economy, protecting its people, protecting its environment. It's the right for a country to do these things, to protect itself against often very harmful foreign direct investment. And very harmful projects, corporations and so forth, essentially marching into whatever country they would like and doing whatever they would like. This is something that countries have the right to protect themselves against. So our declaration supports also universal rights to healthcare, education, water, decent housing, and a healthy environment, and reinforces the idea that we, as the people of the world, need to be having spaces for honest, useful dialogue to address our various crises, especially the climate crisis. And there is no space for that dialogue, certainly here in Cabo. The day before, interesting story, that the day before the summit began, actually the B20, the Business 20 summit was held. This was on Sunday in Cabo, Mexico. So business leaders of the world were wined and dined and given the royal treatment given an opportunity to talk about what they would like to see happen with the G20 leaders. And, of course, the people, those in civil society who are, you know, questioning the G20, who are critical of the G20's neoliberalist policies, we were relegated to La Paz, which is a two-hour drive up the coastline.
Lacey McCauley, we wish you the best of travels and commend you on your participation in the People's Summit in La Paz, Mexico, opposite the Cabo San Lucas G20 Summit. And we note that you are an activist with the Occupy movement in Washington, D.C., so we wish you the best with that, and thank you for being on 5 O'Clock Shadow today.
Thank you so much.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI in New York. I'm Robert Knight, and we thank our producer, Thiago Barroso, and our engineer, Joyce Jones, today for the broadcast, and we welcome your comments, input, tips, suggestions, and leaks with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.